It's 6 after 9. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn for the next 2 weeks here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, Mondays at 9 are reserved for all things political, and this Monday is no exception. We're going to be talking about the latest political news, reviewing the past week's worth of political happenings. Well, probably not all of them. We only have an hour. You can join the discussion at any time by calling 800-642-1234. By sending an email to talk@WPR.org, or you can leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn page on Facebook. My guest this hour is Joseph Kunkel, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Good morning, professor, and welcome to the program.
Morning, John.
Well, let's start with, I guess we could start just about anywhere, but we have to start somewhere. So let's start with Congressman Rangel from New York. He has some serious ethics problems. Just how serious are they for the Democrats in general, and what should the Democrats be doing about it?
Well, the timing couldn't be worse. It just seems like a cascade of bad news for the Democrats, and then to have ethical issues come up from one of their most prominent members, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, is certainly very troublesome. Members of Congress of either party don't like to vote on these types of things, don't like to review their colleagues, so it puts them in a very difficult situation.
Yeah. Why is the Ways and Means Committee so powerful? Explain what that does.
It controls tax law on Social Security primarily. So very, you know, one half of the side of the budget. And affects Americans directly through tax law and through Social Security law.
Well, and this has to be particularly sensitive for the Democrats, since one of the things they ran on as they retook control of the Congress was the whole ethics issue. Tom DeLay and that whole thing was, you know, they were talking about restoring ethics to government and so forth, and now here's Charlie Rangel in trouble.
Well, you know, I think it just feeds public cynicism about government because every time the outs run against the ins on trying to clean up the ethics, and it's my belief that the actual ethical practices improve over time, but we become more sensitive to those lapses that are there, and those lapses are always going to be there. And it's just really, really difficult to change the culture of Washington, to change the partisanship, to keep people from doing bad things. And it's particularly, I don't know, I guess I'd say sad with Chairman Rangel, in that, you know, he's a representative from Harlem. He's waited his whole career to be chairman of Ways and Means, and actually was first elected running in a primary against Adam Clayton Powell, who went down because of some pretty severe ethical lapses years ago.
Well, there's just a whole lot of irony in Washington on any given day.
That's for sure.
Well, let's talk about something else. Moving on, there's so much to get through this hour. More news from WikiLeaks with the release of secret government reports on the war in Afghanistan, painting a very gloomy picture of what's going on over there, as if we weren't already aware that things were pretty gloomy. The documents the release of the documents have made the White House furious with WikiLeaks again. There's a lot of back and forth on this. The White House is basically saying that the whistleblower website opposes U.S. policy in Afghanistan, and they've sort of dismissed these things. What's the actual impact of the release of this secret information?
I think the one impact is going to be more skepticism in Congress and in the in the public opinion about the president's Afghanistan policy, and it was already being called into question quite a bit. It's not surprising that internal government documents are going to paint a more pessimistic view of what's going on than what is being put out publicly.
What about the impact on people who write these documents? I mean, the internal communications of the government suddenly, you know, the supposedly secret documents suddenly coming to light. Does this not have, do you think, some sort of chilling effect on what people are willing to put down? And are we only going to get best case scenario writing from now on?
Well, not necessarily. I don't know that the people who did the writing are going to be held at fault for what they were writing. They're the messengers. So I'm not sure they're necessarily going to be blamed for it. Some cases they might be the people that are releasing the information. We don't really know that, or I don't really know who's releasing this information. You know, again, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, government seems unable to stop leaks of classified information. There's people there that want to get these things out for their own purposes and to be players in the policy process. And White Houses of Democratic and Republican stripe are always going to be outraged by these things. They're going to try to crack down on it, but it's still going to be a real factor in policy decisions going forward.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, your chance to weigh in on the political news of the week. What did you think, what was your big story politically of the week? Call in and let us know, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can join us on Facebook. Kathleen Dunn has a Facebook fan page. Go there, leave a comment on the wall, and we will share it with the radio audience here on the program. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. We're in the midst of all things political and wondering what your take is on some of the political stories of the week. And there are quite a few right now where we are talking about the whole WikiLeaks thing. That's one of the more recent pieces. Of course, the Sunday morning talk shows yesterday produced some political news of their own. We had Secretary of the Treasury Timothy Geithner making the rounds of a couple of the shows. There's the whole Shirley Sherrod situation and a lot of other stories to talk about. Let's talk about the case of Shirley Sherrod at the Department of Agriculture. There are a number of things that we can talk about here, Professor, not the least of which is the manipulated video that started the ball rolling.
Well, it's week two on this story now, so we're coming back to what the real issue is there, because we spent 3 or 4 days listening to the administration apologize for firing her too quickly. They ended up with a lot of egg on their face, but it was actually Fox News and this Got Ya blogger who had perpetrated the original misdeed, and you weren't hearing much from them, although Bill O'Reilly did apologize.
Well, this morning in the our 6 o'clock program, Joy Cardine had on a media person who was defending the person who originally, I didn't get to actually hear the whole program, but this person was defending the actions of this blogger. I guess I'm just thinking, there seems to have been a line that's become increasingly blurry between who's a journalist and whether bloggers qualify for this or not. And I'd like to just get your take on this.
Well, the line is blurry, and becomes even blurrier when you have basically people who are not journalists who have the means through modern media to manufacture news, and then this gets picked up by one or two real media, and then the other media feel they have to report on it as well. So it's able to they're able to shape, you know, what legitimate journalists are carrying, are covering.
Well, and you know, and it just seems to me. I mean, I've been in broadcasting for an awfully long time, but and it just seems to me that these days there's a whole lot less quality control in terms of what gets on the air than there used to be. For example, the idea that no one bothered to check or even ask any questions about where this video came from or anything. I mean, it took a number of days before this came out that this video was actually manipulated.
Yes, some of that has to do with probably journalistic laziness. I think it's probably market driven in that different media outlets don't want to get scooped on this. And I think it's a reflection of our political culture, which is so much really focused around outrage, that we hear something and we're expected to be outraged by it, and it feeds into our preconceptions. And I think even legitimate media outlets feel that they, must respond to the political culture and to their audience and express a sense of outrage, and it leads to simplification. And one thing we can learn from this is just because you see something on a video or hear something on a tape, that doesn't mean it's necessarily true, what you're hearing. There's something called context. And, there's amazing things that can be done as far as editing of images and pictures and so forth. So, I don't think we definitely haven't seen the last of this and haven't hit bottom on how bad this type of thing can get.
Well, you mentioned outrage. There's a lot of money to be made by being outrageous. And I'm not going to name any names, but I mean, there are people who make a lot of money by being increasingly outrageous. Have we reached the point where there's so much money to be made through this kind of behavior that there's just no way to actually to change the culture?
Yeah, changing culture is rather difficult. I mean, when you talk about money being made on being outrageous, this makes me think more of reality TV and things like this, and then talk radio shows, not this one, of course, but some of the more bombastic types, where what they're basically peddling is outrage. And there's so much going on of that that seems to be the normal first reaction instead of a little bit more thoughtful approach.
We have callers who want to join us, and why don't we take a quick call before our first break here? So we'll go to Scott in Sturgeon Bay first. Scott, good morning.
Good morning. I guess it kind of makes sense. We're talking about journalism a little bit and real journalism as opposed to the fringe journalism. But I think the lines are so blurred. I mean, I think it's a big story. The journalist story that came out on Daily Caller about all these journalists, mainstream, getting together, kind of this threaded blog kind of world where they basically talk to each other. And you read that and you find out there's a tremendous amount of groupthink in mainstream journalism, and it's all slanted to the left. I mean, you've got somebody from National Public Radio said they'd laugh if Rush Limbaugh had a heart attack in front of them. I mean, you've got, I think it was Ezra Klein saying, we really need to get together and we need to call a couple of these guys racist, so that kind of detracts from heat on the Obama campaign. I mean, the public has really lost trust in a lot of journalism, and I think it has to do with this groupthink, and everybody seems to live in this little journalistic left-leaning bubble that has really caused a lot of skepticism, and I think it may be part of the cause for all this fringe journalism that you see.
Well, Scott, I just want to make a quick fact correction on one aspect of what you say. We want to discuss that because, in general terms, that's a huge point. There was no that was not an NPR journalist or even a journalist who made the Rush Limbaugh comment on a listserv. It was an employee of a public radio station in California, but not part of the journalism department, and certainly not an NPR employee. But Professor, what about it? I mean, groupthink, I think, was that's a very insightful comment by Scott. There does seem to be an awful lot of follow the leader.
Well, the caller makes two charges: one of groupthink, and then it's groupthink on the left. And I think what is being blurred and what we're losing is ideas of professional responsibility and accountability to some kind of higher standards. I think the caller is correct in that Americans are losing trust in journalists, but they're losing trust in authority figures of all kinds. and the internet and blogs and tweets and YouTube and all these other more grassroots media create the opportunity for people to create their own news and create their own reality. I really think it's harder for professional journalists to develop some kind of a groupthink because they're having to respond to all these other reports, initiatives, blogs, and other types of information that are out there, too, and to compete with that and try and figure out what their role is and how they're going to survive.
We're talking about all things political this morning on the Kathleen Dunn Program. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We'll be taking more of your calls and emails and Facebook comments as we move along in the program. Here's the phone number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. A couple of lines available for you if you call right now. If you'd like to send an email, the address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page and leave a comment there, and we'll share it with the radio audience. As I said, we're doing all things political today, and here's your chance to weigh in on the political news. My guest is Joseph Kunkel, professor of the Political Science Department at Minnesota State University, Mankato. He'll be with us for the hour, and you can be too. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. 23 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week and next week as well. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. After 11, Larry Mueller talks with a personal trainer about how you can exercise at work, even in your cubicle. That ought to be interesting. That's after 11 o'clock this morning here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all things political. And my guest is Joseph Kunkel, who is a professor of the Political Science Department at Minnesota State University, Mankato. And we have more callers, Professor, who want to join us. Let's take some more calls. So we'll start with Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks. Well, I'm pretty concerned about the climate change bill being dropped. And I'm just very concerned about the issue in general. And it really worries me that the public doesn't seem to take it seriously. A lot of people don't. And it just seems like people are no one wants to think that it could really be as bad as scientists say. And I just feel like people are just in denial. And I blame part of it on the media for not covering it more. I feel like, you know, with the consequences that are happening right now and that scientists predict will happen, it should be the first story, like, all the time, because this is going to trump every other issue. I mean, in 20 years, no one's going to be arguing about anything else. And I also like to mention that the Pew Research Center did a poll of scientists a couple years ago, and they found that 80%, and this is worldwide scientists, 80% of all scientists from all disciplines believe that global warming was happening, it was caused by people, and something like 97%. I know it was above 95%. I think it was 97% of climatologists believed that. And, I mean, why would 97% of climatologists, like, want to say something that they didn't believe was true? I mean, hello? Hello?
Yeah, we get it, Sarah. Let's let the professor have a chance to comment.
Well, climate change, you know, I think that raises some important issues. Why are people not more concerned about this? I think there's, are people going to believe a bunch of scientists talking about this? Okay, you've got scientists that are talking about something that is going to happen eventually, and the caller is convinced that this is happening, and maybe many people are convinced that this is happening, but it's hard to get people to make immediate sacrifices for something that there's going to be a long-term benefit, and then there's a long-term question about it. So in the current climate, people are concerned more about jobs and the economy, and it becomes, I think, a compelling argument that if you know, to put taxes on carbon emission is going to increase the cost of doing business, going to hurt hurt jobs. I think there's probably a certain amount of skepticism out there about what scientists are saying. Just because some scientists are saying something, are people going to necessarily change their behavior in ways that are actually going to cost them money in a time of economic recession? And then, you know, for their own reasons, you know, you have business and Republicans and conservatives pushing back and calling into question the competence of the science and the scientists and emphasizing the economic cost. You know, we see this on a lot of issues. We can look at the growth of the budget deficit and healthcare costs and Social Security, where we can see disasters coming in the future. And if we'll just act now, it won't be so bad. But the longer we wait, the harder it's going to be. But yet it's very, very difficult in a democracy to get people to make real economic sacrifices now for some imagined to prevent some imagined catastrophe in the future.
Sarah, thanks. Thanks for the call. Well, the Democrats did kind of pull the plug on the climate change bill. It seems that this was no surprise, I don't think, because they were already even last year during the healthcare debate, Democrats were saying, "Hey," they were asking the president not to make them walk the plank on climate change as well. Because they were already in trouble. Was this a political calculation saying we just can't do one more thing like this with the election looming?
Well, they just didn't have the votes to do it. Republicans have taken their obstructionist tactic in the Senate. And on climate change, it would be even more difficult to get all the Democrats lined up. But in the Senate, you know, you've got to have 60 votes to move things, and that that puts the minority Republicans in a very strong position. And if they're digging in their heels on something, it just isn't going to happen. So, you know, I think to say that the Democrats pulled the plug on it is more that they just recognized that the plug had already been pulled on it, and there wasn't much they could do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, climate change passed the House some time ago, and you know, if we had a national legislature, and particularly a Senate that operated on the basis of majority rule, it would have passed last year. But it's just unrealistic to expect major controversial legislation to be passed in the summer before an election when the party in charge is deeply threatened.
Well, the more cynical among the populace might say that that there doesn't seem to be any real interest in governing. The idea is more or less to stop whoever the opposition is from doing whatever it is they want, regardless of whether it's good or bad. The fact that the other side wants to do it makes it automatically bad, and don't do anything. Just make sure that nothing happens that somebody else wants to support.
Well, that's the situation. That's the policy that the Republicans are taking right now. That they're blocking even really things that in the past have been non-controversial and nonpartisan, like extending unemployment benefits. That's something that the parties have come together on in the past, and the Republicans are digging in their heels on this. Now we can go back and look at history and find examples where the Democrats have done a similar thing, but you know, this the level of unity in the Republicans in Congress in opposing, you know, virtually anything that the Democrats in the Obama administration come up with is quite novel and is quite new.
Yeah, we have a comment from just to move on to another topic that may be a little bit related to this because, it's all things political anyway. But Annie from La Crosse asks, who will take up the political news mantle at National Public Radio with Daniel Shore's passing?
No, there's just some shoes that you can't fill. When somebody like Daniel Shore passes on, you know, there are many, I'm sure, that are inspired by him and are trying to live up to his standards. But You can't replace somebody like that.
Well, let's talk about Daniel Shore. I mean, he had a long and storied career. He was one of Ed Murrow's boys, and got crossways with the Nixon administration, which in some respects didn't take a whole lot, but was in the middle of some pretty big stories during the time that Richard Nixon was the president of the United States.
Yep, I think he was proud that he turned up on Nixon's enemies list. He was actually reporting the fact that there was this so-called enemies list in the Nixon administration, and he's reading the names and comes across his own name on there. I think he was, you know, he hadn't really pre-read it and was quite surprised to find his name on there.
Well, and he was one of those journalists from the 50s who had a very distinctive delivery. He certainly wasn't the kind of sprayed on, good looking person that we see on television all the time now. He had seemed to have some real character and a personality.
Right, and you know, he came out of that older journalistic tradition. And, you know, was part of that really unleashing of investigative journalism in the Nixon years. I think that kind of results in this appearance of this adversarial approach that journalists are taking with respect to the government, and particularly on national security. And it probably contributes to perception of some that... You know, you have left-wing groupthink among the journalists. And, you know, in his later career and then on NPR, he pretty much cut loose and was doing editorial work and, you know, was giving these biting critiques and commentaries. Which was different than what he had been doing earlier.
Yeah, but that brings up a point. And I'm going to go all the way back to what our caller Scott had earlier, talking about. It seems to me that there's an assumption now that because someone has a political opinion, that they can't anything that they do as a journalist is tainted by that. At some point, don't we have to say, look, there are professional standards. Everybody has opinions. So if we say that if you have an opinion, you can't be an objective journalist, then no one can be a journalist. Don't we have to at some point give a little bit of a benefit of the doubt to say, okay, so what if somebody has an opinion on an issue? If they are following journalistic standards and reporting facts, you know, facts don't lean left or right. They're just facts.
Well, I agree with that. You know, and I think people in many professions would agree with that. I know as a professor that, you know, I would agree with that in a similar situation, that you would have your own opinions, but you could be objective in presenting the information. But I think a certain percentage, and probably an increasing percentage of the population, doesn't really believe that and thinks that because journalists have opinions that they are slanting the news, and that it is more reliable then to get your information from websites, blogs, and so forth, where it's straight up advocacy with no real attempt at professional neutrality. And then I think you also have on television and radio people that are going to take that more partisan, opinionated approach and use it to build ratings for as an entertainment product.
Well, and it's so easy now to simply find news outlets, and I'll put that in italics, that agree with whatever our worldview happens to be. I don't care if you're left, right, center, whatever it is. You can find a website or a series of websites or a television network or a radio commentator or something that will basically support your worldview, and we feel more comfortable there, and so that's where we gravitate. Maybe we have too many choices.
Right. Well, I think when you look at, particularly when you look at the internet news and the options there, that there is that kind of narrowcasting that goes on. When when your news sources were, you know, one or two newspapers in town and three networks and two or three radio stations that were associated with those networks, You didn't have that many choices. But I think more people have to realize that what really becoming informed and what educated is exposing yourself to different viewpoints and calling into question your preconceptions and your worldview, so that you're testing those ideas all the time.
Challenge your assumptions. That's a big rule in my house.
Right.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Matt in Appleton. Matt, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the air. Say, I just wanted to tell or to say a comment here, and I think we need to back up. I mean, the right fights the left fights the right. The way I see it, I don't belong to either one of the parties. I see them as kids, and that one will do whatever they can to damage the other. And if we back up even a little bit further and we take a look at this, our Constitution reads, "We the people." And I think if we look at how our government is set up, it should say, "We the corporations of the United States," because they're the ones lobbying our Congress and senators. And they're the ones, that's how they're making their decision. In essence, they're bribing for the way they vote. It's got to change. This is definitely a problem. And I thank you very much and hope that we get a lot of comments on this. Thank you very much for having me on the air.
Matt, thanks for the call. Professor?
Well, no doubt. Corporations have a big role to play in our political system. I mean, we allow people to organize and to try to influence the government, and corporations have both huge interests at stake and the means to influence that. Are corporations really the dominant factor? I think any administration is going to have to consider corporate opinion, but the current administration is being accused of being anti-business and anti-corporate, is trying to do some small things to change things. So no doubt a big role to play. I think there's going to be a bigger role to play after a Supreme Court decision allowing, direct corporate contributions to political campaigns, and in some ways, the corporations and unions are going to be freer to contribute to campaigns than our political parties. Political parties are, not very popular, and the Supreme Court has been more willing to allow corporations and unions to be involved in unregulated spending in elections.
Mm-hmm. 800-642-1234. That's the phone number to call. 800-642-1234. You can also reach us via email at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, or on Facebook. There's a Kathleen Dunn Facebook page. You can go there and leave a comment as well. But the phone number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. It's just about 9:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn for the next couple of weeks. And coming up a little bit later on this afternoon on the Ideas Network, after 3 on Here on Earth, it's the best of the Inside Islam series. Gene Faraca's guest tells the story of the rise of Islam through the eyes of Aisha, the Prophet Muhammad's youngest wife, one of the most influential women in Islamic history. That's coming up after 3 o'clock today on the Ideas Network. Next hour, we're going to be talking about undocumented dairy workers in the state of Wisconsin. There may be as many as 5,000 of them, amounting to some 40% of the dairy workforce in the state. And that has raised a number of issues, not the least of which is what happens when these people drive? They don't have licenses and can't get them. We'll have a couple of guests next hour to talk about that program. This hour, it's All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. And my guest is Joseph Kunkel, professor of political science at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Well, Professor, I want to move on to some other topics. We've spent a lot of time talking about the media, but there's a lot of other political news out there, and I think we'll just move on from that. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner made the rounds of the talk shows over the weekend. The Obama administration, of course, is hailing the passage last week of sweeping financial reform, and they're calling it part of, their term for it is recovery summer. But some people are asking, where are the jobs? Tim Geithner, he's talking about things like, we've got this financial reform package passed and things are looking up and we're headed forward.
Well, this is part of the problem that the Obama administration is facing, that they're actually getting some major pieces of legislation passed, but these things are not accomplishing things that people are going to feel in an immediate way. Financial reform package is supposed to prevent some future disaster. So that doesn't really do anything that people are going to experience now. The health care bill isn't really kicking in for 4 years or so, and people aren't really experiencing any benefits from that. What people are experiencing is job loss and uncertainty and fear about their economic situation. There was a stimulus bill that was passed early in the administration, and supposedly this helped keep the recession from getting worse. But that's hard to sell too.
That's a tough argument to make.
It would have been worse if we hadn't done anything. But I think as long as unemployment remains high and people are pessimistic about the economy, there's not going to be too much that the Obama administration can do that's going to be very, very popular. If unemployment had come down, they'd probably be pretty popular in everything they're doing right now.
Well, you know, that's just it, though. I mean, there isn't we've all been captured by this current quarter mentality that seems to have enslaved the corporate world. Anything you do, if it doesn't have some immediate impact, it's a failure. And some of these things just take time to work out.
Yeah, they take time to work out. It's actually limited what government can do. According to the latest economic theory, that in a recession, that government should be stimulating the economy and spending when business doesn't, and they've done that, but there's political limits on how much they can do.
Well, there certainly are, and we have there's a lot of unrest over the size of the deficit, and that's certainly something that's all of a sudden on people's minds. I don't know why it wasn't on people's minds as much when we were borrowing billions in the early part of the decade, but it seems to be on people's minds now. Maybe it's just finally penetrated, but that's a big concern.
The other thing too is that you don't get elected to office, and particularly to the presidency, by saying, listen, folks, we're facing difficult problems, and there's really not that much I can do. I can't give you a whole lot of hope. I'm going to do my best, but that's going to be about it. You get elected to presidency by raising people's hope, raising people's expectation, saying that you're going to change the climate in Washington, saying that you're going to have economic growth without deficits, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and Obama is particularly susceptible to this. That in the campaign, he did this very well and raised people's expectations, and now those high expectations are coming back to bite him.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Jim in Chippewa Falls. Jim, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. In that same vein, I hear people complain, just as you were mentioning, where. Yeah, I kind of argue, give the guy some time. We've got a Congress that is basically blocking for whatever reason, and he's trying to get things done, but it's, give some time. And actually, if I can kind of back up on stuff a little bit, I know you want to change the subject, but why isn't there any libel laws when you have in politics. I mean, isn't there some type of slander or libel laws so that we kind of get some type of resistance to immediately coming out and telling untruths? If they have to verify what it is they're saying before they publish it, wouldn't that help?
Well, I want to have the professor respond, but Jim, if you want the quick answer to that, Google Sullivan versus the New York Times. That will tell you what you need to know about how libel laws apply to public figures. But, Professor, go ahead.
Yeah, libel laws are libel laws, but particularly when you're talking about political speech, they're going to run up against the First Amendment, and the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, is going to be given precedence.
Yeah, it's a tough question because there's a balancing act there. But Jim, good luck on your quest for information on that one. Let's go to Severy in Black River. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I just had a comment on corporate America that the gentleman earlier was voicing his concern. I feel that over 50 years ago, one of our presidents, who was also a five-star general, well-versed in the military and intelligence and probably corporate America, warned the American people on television upon leaving the presidency about the military-industrial complex, which was operating at that time even, which was accountable to no one and had pretty much monopolized the resources of this country. And it's kind of like it's fallen on deaf ears. It's the elephant in the room that nobody really wants to talk about. And 50 years have gone on, and it's obviously still happening. Thank you.
Professor?
Well, America went through a great change after World War II. America's role in the world changed dramatically after World War II. There are attempts now and then to rein in the military-industrial complex, but unless somebody can figure out a way to fundamentally change America's role in the world and American foreign policy, they haven't been able to achieve that.
Thanks for the call, I'm having trouble talking this morning. 800-642-1234. That's what I meant to say. That's the phone number. There's a line open for you right now, and you can join the program. 800-642-1234. I want to go back to something that Timothy Geithner talked about on ABC News this week. The Bush tax cuts are set to expire, and looks like most of those cuts will be allowed to expire. Timothy Geithner is defending that, saying that the cuts that are expiring, that should expire, are the ones that go to the top 2 or 3% in terms of income in the United States, and that the tax cuts that would do the most good would be aimed at the middle class. Are we going to be seeing more and more of this kind of thing in terms of, well, I don't want to bring it, well, maybe I will, but is this an example of kind of a little bit of class warfare, or is this the Treasury Secretary talking about what he feels is sound economic policy?
Well, maybe a little bit of both. I mean, this is what Barack Obama campaigned on, that he would let those tax cuts expire, for the upper income group, but that he would protect the so-called middle class people. This is just another really controversial issue to be dealing with at this time. I don't think it's at all clear how it's going to turn out. Yes, they could just, if nothing happens, tax cuts will expire, but the tax cut would also expire for the middle class, which would, be politically unpopular thing to do. So the Democrats are going to want to try to extend those tax cuts for some and let them expire for others, which means there would have to be some action going through the Congress, which means that the Republicans, particularly in the Senate, would be able to at a minimum, provoke extended debate and controversy on the issue and possibly shape the outcome. And the Democrats are not completely unanimous in their own ranks on this, that there's an argument to be made that letting taxes go up on wealthy people some of whom own businesses, is going to be bad for business at a time when business is already hesitant to hire people and put people back on the job rolls.
Let's take a call next from Greg in Montez. Greg, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hi. I'd like to reiterate and little amplify a little bit on what a caller mentioned a few callers back about corporate influence, and he talked about, he brought up the media, I think, having a role in it. What I really think, I think he has a lot, there's a lot in that. There's a lot in that, and Congress has let media ownership grow to a really unhealthy level. It kills diversity. There's less reporting going on, so there's less diverse reporting going on. There's less competition to get real facts out there for the public, and diversity of fact. And plus, in the electronic media, well, in all media really, but the electronic media chiefly, this is a real conundrum, because none of these huge corporations, first of all, my belief is that corporations do a lot that support one another. So the bigger they get, the more they are in line with entire industries politically. This is what has caused, in my view, one of the narrowing of vision within the Republican Party is that it's gotten so extremely myopic in its view, and their diverse Republicans are no longer really have a voice there. That's part of it. But the other thing is that these media conglomerates are powerful entities that rely on other powerful industries and powerful industries, and they can't really, network television, for instance, can't really take into account stories that will be offensive to whole industries or huge players within industries, and so those stories won't really get play. I've been watching the media since college. I'm 58 years old. I'm a critical thinker. I took a lot of philosophy that taught me about veracity of argument and the need for information in order to feed that whole process and keep the American democratic principles alive. So we have real undue corporate influence that I think is systemic. It's what allows us to have such things as captive regulators, as in the minerals management area and of our government. And we have a lot of that same kind of stuff going on in the FDA, where people and other agencies, USDA, FDA, huge corporations go in and basically, through their lobbyists, make statements in there. And this keeps the hot-button issue of true campaign finance reform out of the public eye and ear. And we are it works well for both parties, basically, because it perpetuates polarity, but polarity gets more extreme and narrow. And
yeah, Greg,
all of this has happened, I think, concurrent with the degradation of popular media that has happened in my lifetime.
Greg, we need to let the professor have a chance to respond, because we're almost out of time here today. Professor?
Yeah, I'd say the caller provides a lot of interesting information. And actually, the information he's providing kind of undermines his essential point. If there's such groupthink among the media and there's such a narrow range of viewpoints presented, how does he get as informed as he is? Well, he is a critical thinker, and he's obviously able to find other sources of information to criticize, the alleged groupthink that's coming out there. So I think that there is a lot of information that people can get, but they have to be more active in trying to pursue it. Question is, what do you do with these perspectives, whether it's corporate dominance or media dominance? Are people just going to be cynical and apathetic, or are they going to try to move the system? If we just say that we've got these conspiracies of big entities that are controlling everything, and then we're just critics and we feel powerless, then our democracy is on the downside. we don't know how much we can influence things, but you know, the challenge of democracy is really that people have to try. Even if you think the corporations or the media are really dominating things, can you, as citizens and grassroots organizations, really change things? You just have to try.
The truth is out there, and we just have to keep digging until we find it. Apparently,
I think so.
Well, Professor, we have reached the end of the hour, and I just wanted to say thank you for being here and helping us get this discussion moving and keeping it on track.
Very enjoyable, and I appreciate hearing from all these different points in Wisconsin.
All right. Joseph Kunkel is a professor of the Political Science Department, where he's also the chair at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Appreciate his presence on the broadcast this morning. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. Rachel Owens handled on-air production duties for us this morning. Coming up, we're going to talk about the dairy industry in the state of Wisconsin. Nothing unusual about that, except perhaps you didn't know that as much as 40% of the employment in the dairy industry goes to undocumented workers. And that presents a whole series of challenges, and we'll have two guests next hour to talk about that. By the way, if you missed part of this hour, all things political, you can go to our website, WPR.org. Listen to the whole thing all over again. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR.